Richard, you know those things I mentioned that I wanted to get in to with you. Could we talk just a little bit about your books? I don't have a note here as to when they came out, Hidden in Plain Sight, Beyond the X-Files, and Underwater and Underground Bases, and then the third one here, Underground Bases and Tunnels, What is the Government Trying to Hide? Would you mind getting into that with us?
Absolutely. You know, when I moved out to the Southwest region, in the New Mexico and Arizona region in the late 1980s, I, for the first time, began hearing about purported little gray aliens that are alleged to be working in great secrecy in very highly secure underground bases and tunnels with covert elements, clandestine elements of the United States military agencies. Well, I had never heard this before in that way, and so I found the stories peculiar. I mean, people that I ran into in the course of my everyday life were talking about these things. There's a certain segment of society in the Southwest region of the United States that has some knowledge of UFOs and extraterrestrials, and then there are a great many military facilities in the Southwestern region of the United States, so people, there's a lot of local lore about what the military is up to, not only Area 51, but other places, Hill Air Force Base in Utah, of course, Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado, White Sands Air Force Base in New Mexico, Kirtland Air Force Base, Fort Huachuca in Arizona, Nellis in Nevada, on and on. The whole region has major, huge, sprawling military reservations. Those are some of the better known ones. There are certainly many others. So I started hearing these types of stories and didn't know what to think about them. I was overwhelmed with a deluge of academic work at the time, so I wasn't able to look into them in any detail. However, when my schedule opened up a little bit and I had more control over my daily activities and could organize my time more to my liking, I began to look into the question, at least of underground installations, subterranean bases. And I quickly discovered through an open literature search facilities like Site R, which is so-called underground Pentagon on the border between Maryland and Pennsylvania, Mount Weather, which is another large underground base about an hour's drive outside of Washington, D.C., in the Appalachian Mountains. Of course, the NORAD base, Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado, and some other facilities of these types. So I wrote up a little article for UFO Magazine, in at that time was published out of Los Angeles by Vicki Cooper and Don Ecker. I believe the magazine has since gone out of circulation, but at that time it was very much a going concern. And I published a little article in their magazine in the first part of November of 1992 that said, essentially, yes, there are underground bases that can be quite large and deep and technologically sophisticated, and here are a few of them that my research has uncovered. But as to the question of little gray aliens that are alleged to be underground in any of these sorts of facilities, I can say nothing because I found no documentation in that regard. I wrote that up. That little article appeared in their magazine. And at that point, I felt like I had exhausted the topic. Well, several weeks later, in the week between Christmas and New Year's, that same year, 1992, I was awakened from a deep sleep one night in the wee hours of the morning, maybe 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. I was living alone in an alley apartment in Albuquerque. I was very quiet. The only other entity in the house with me was my cat. And I couldn't hear anything, so I wasn't sure why I had awakened. So suddenly I awoke abruptly, but I was very relaxed physically and very alert mentally. It's an unusual state to be in. Within mere seconds, I heard a matter-of-fact voice speak very calmly and clearly in my ear. It was the voice of an adult Caucasian male speaking normally accented, educated, university-educated, late 20th century North American English. He started his comments to me by saying, very straightforwardly, the underground bases are real. And I was thinking, no joke. Wow. And he went on to talk to me briefly, maybe 2 or 3 minutes at the most, just to tell me that, yes, they are real. They can be very large, very complex, very sophisticated technologically, that there are large, major projects and programs being carried out underground. As he spoke, I got the impression of just massive organized activity with extensive involvement by agencies and corporations and organizations, but all in great compartmentalized secrecy. Massive activity, but compartmentalized and highly secret, so that although all of this massive activity was taking place down there, and I now know still is, the average person would have little or no inkling whatsoever as to what was going on, because it is out of sight and therefore out of mind, and very carefully contrived to be out of sight and out of mind. Now, he stopped speaking just as abruptly as he had begun. I never had any idea that I was hearing the voice of God or of the devil or of an extraterrestrial or of demons or angels or anything like that, or that I was going crazy. I understood from the very beginning that by some technological means a voice transmission was being beamed to the auditory cortex, my inner ear, and that I was being spoken to by a flesh and blood man who had knowledge of this and was giving me a data download in somewhat the same vein as what the Bone Lady did in 1958. Only in this case, I am thoroughly persuaded, was then and still am, that I was being targeted by a brain transmitter, by a specific flesh and blood man within this, somewhere within this great beehive of activity, and who wanted me to know something more about it. Why? Presumably because he saw that little article that I wrote in UFO magazine and had access to technology that permitted him to tune in and give me a larger clue. Well, based on that, the following morning I certainly remembered what had happened during the night, and I determined that I could conduct an extensive document search, literature search, of the openly available documentation from government, from military, from industry, from think tanks, from whatever source I could find in the open literature, and see if I could piece together what was going on. I ultimately have ended up writing these three little paperback books for the popular market, which have sold a surprising number of, I guess going on 30,000 copies at this point over a period of about 20 years. They're underground bestsellers. I've never made the New York Times bestseller list. People like me do not get written up in the New York Times because I talk about too many things. The power structure, I would rather not have people think very deeply about, if at all. But I was given these little prods for whatever reason, and I have looked into it far more deeply than almost anyone else outside of the programs themselves, and have put together these books. Essentially, I've written the type of book that I wanted to read but could not find when I went to the library. And you know, sometimes if you want something done, you must do it yourself. And that's what I've done. Now, the first one came out in about 1994, but not in paperback form. I just wrote it up on a word processor and ran it off at the local copy center and put a spiral binding on it and went around asking people, do you want to read my self-published book on this weird topic? And surprisingly, people did. I started selling hundreds of them. I had no idea. And so my younger brother at that time had a small publishing business, and he said, you know, a lot of people are interested in what you've written. How about if I just published it a limited run, I think, of 500 copies or something like that of the book under my own, through my own little publishing business. I said, wonderful, that'd be great. So he did, and those sold out. So then, one step at a time, it got into more and more circulation, and ultimately, David Hatcher Childress, who has Adventures Unlimited Press in Illinois, picked up that book and started printing it and selling it. It's still in print. That is Underground Bases and Tunnels. What does a government? What is the government trying to hide? And then I subsequently wrote another one about 7 years later, Underwater and Underground Bases. And then I, in 2010, early 2010, came out with Hidden in Plain Sight, Beyond the X-Files. And what it amounts to is that there's a wide variety of agencies and organizations, not all governmental, not all military, though the military is a major player underground and undersea. And other agencies are also major players. But there are all kinds of underground facilities. Some of them can be very large and very deep. And I do know, based on my research, that some of them are so secret that we don't know where they are, only that they exist. We don't even know their number, the total number. I am now guessing as well, based on my research and reading in some conversations I've had, that there may be clandestine facilities on the moon and on Mars as well, quite likely below the surface.
You know, I saw a number of photographs. A huge collection of photographs was sent to me at one point because of someone's interest in underground bases. And, you know, I can't authenticate these photos at all, but they're talking submarine bases as far into the interior of the continental United States, as far in as Arizona and Nevada. And there were these photographs of these huge boring machines. Now, I can't prove where these photographs were taken. But, I mean, it was a compelling set of photographs that they're actually inlets for gigantic, you know, undersea vessels, great big ones, that are able to go through these underground canals and so forth and stay well protected beneath the Earth's surface way up into the interior. It's just nuts. And I guess it's possible. I mean, they have nothing to do all day and they have virtually an unlimited budget, so why not?
Yeah, I've heard those same stories. I can't rule them out or in. What I can tell you is, based on my research, that I've been told that there are indeed tunnels, by ex-military personnel, I've been told this, that there are tunnels on both coasts of North America where the large military submarines, and these are truly large vessels, they're 500-600 feet long, and from the bottom of the hull to the top of the conning tower, they can be 100 feet in some cases. So they are enormous submarines, and yet the technology as of the mid-1960s was under research and design by the United States Navy through a task force at the China Lake Naval Weapons Station out in the desert in California to design and build huge manned deep undersea facilities that would be accessed by tunnels. We're talking, you're down undersea, 1,000 feet underwater in mid-ocean, and to create these facilities actually in the bedrock or in seamounts, well out to sea, hundreds or thousands of miles out to sea, which would be able to accommodate 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 Ohio-class submarines at a time, along with the crews and some degree of comfort with barracks and cafeterias, mess halls, recreation facilities, power plants, on and on. And so you're talking, if you got four large military submarines, you're talking about maybe easily 500 or 600 officers and crew, plus you would have personnel to maintain the base, plus you would need the space to actually bring these submarines into massive underwater berths, and then you would have the huge airlocks deep undersea to accommodate multiple very large military submarines at a time. And this was being actively planned back in the mid-1960s by the United States Navy at China Lake Naval Weapons Station. I have some of that documentation, which has been declassified, and I cite that in my books, and also cite in a third book documentation that I found from, that originated from the Stanford Research Institute, which is a, has been for decades, a military-industrial espionage complex think tank out in California for a long time. It had institutional ties to Stanford University. My understanding is it is no longer a research unit of the university, but it bears the name, and it is located very close by Stanford University, and still does. It still is a think tank for the military-industrial espionage complex, has been for half a century easy, just very much like the RAND Corporation, for example. So the Stanford Research Institute came out with a study not much different from what the Navy had come out with in 1966. The SRI study came out, I would say, if I remember correctly, about 1969 or something like that, a few years later. And it made much the same point. It went a little bit further than the Navy had in discussing, at that time, three possible uses for such a base. One, for scientific research purposes. Two, you could use it for industrial purposes, like mining, for example. Or three, for military purposes, one of which would be secret nuclear missile emplacement, actually, on the seafloor, so you could have tunnels running deeply beneath the seafloor in the bedrock, and then you would have nuclear missile silos actually set in the seafloor, and then connected to all of that would be an underground base to run all of that. And actually, one of the illustrations I got, there's a wonderful military illustrator named Walter Kirshner. He's very elderly now. But Walter contacted me, heard me on one of my radio interviews. Walter is a great fan of late night radio and has been for years. He contacted me after hearing one of my interviews and said, you know, I was a career military illustrator. I illustrated for a variety of military projects over the years. And one of the projects I worked on was the planning, the R&D work for the manned undersea bases for the United States Navy. And he gave me a treasure trove of illustrations regarding his work for that. And one of them was depicting graphically just one of those bases where the large military submarine would be brought in deep undersea, and there would be a large multi-chamber undersea base there. And then it's all connected through a deep shaft and tunnels spreading laterally or horizontally beneath the seafloor, connecting multiple undersea nuclear missile silos embedded in the seafloor. Now, I believe this has been done. I found another piece of information in that regard in the book entitled Silent War by John Pena Craven. John Pena Craven was the navies. He worked for the Navy, setting up their very deep undersea program during the height of the Cold War. He was tasked by the naval hierarchy with developing the capability for the 20th century Navy, post-World War II Navy, to work at great depth in the ocean, at depths up to 20,000 feet, which is almost 4 miles straight down. That's very, very deep indeed. And he did that. He developed a whole suite of technologies, a lot of which remain classified to this day. But in his book, he mentioned at one point that Dr. Edward Teller, and yes, John Pena Craven, worked at a very high level, or deep level, as you wish, of the military-industrial espionage complex. He was an insider's insider. But he mentioned that at one point, Dr. Edward Teller had wanted him to develop glass missile silos for emplacement in the ocean floor. Why missile emplacements made out of glass? Here's the reason why. Under extreme pressure, glass has 20 times more structural strength and integrity than high-grade steel. It's hard to believe, but it's true. So if you're going to build at great depth undersea and build for stability and strength and structural integrity, you will build with glass. Now, in our topside environment, we think of glass as being very brittle, and that's correct. However, when you're undersea, a well-designed glass structure is extremely strong, far stronger than one built of steel. It's counterintuitive, but it's true. So Dr. Teller wanted him to do that. I don't know if the Navy ever did. John Pena Craven clearly would not, I don't think, say that in a book that he's written for a mass popular market. But he did make that one cryptic mention. Now, that data point propped up three times in my research, in the comments by Dr. Pena Craven, in the illustrations that I got from Walter Kirshner, who was the military illustrator working with the Navy's unmanned undersea base program in the 1960s, which was classified then, but some of that documentation has since been declassified. You know, about a half a century has passed. And then also in the documentation I got from the SRI, the Stanford Research Institute. So these three sources are talking about making nuclear missile fields and planting nuclear missile silos at the bottom of the sea. I'm guessing something like that probably has been done. If I had to guess as to where it has been done, I would think the Gulf of Mexico would be one logical location. I would think the Great Lakes would be another possible location. I would think the continental shelf of eastern North America would be another very likely location. There may be others, but those three areas would be very high on my list. I'm suspecting something like that has probably been done. And I would say that I have gotten, I once did an interview earlier this year with a host who had been in the Navy, and I keep talking to these people, even in South America, under the most improbable of circumstances. I keep getting bits and pieces of information. This host was in the Navy and worked at the Altec facility in the Bahamas. Not only there, but he did work there at one time, and told me that Altec facility is the Navy's undersea warfare facility in the Bahamas, and in the coastal waters adjacent to Andros Island, which is not too far off the coast of Florida. It's Bahamian territory, but there's a United States naval base there and has been, I think, since the 1950s for a long time. And, of course, the United States has hundreds of military facilities all over the world. This is one of them. My understanding, according to the conversation we had, was that the huge Navy submarines, United States Navy submarines, are brought in through tunnels from the open ocean and into an underground base that they have beneath Andros Island to be refitted, repaired, what have you. So that's one example that I've learned of just in recent months. But it's very much consistent with the documentation that I got already 10 years ago or more, 15 years ago, pertaining to these plans for making undersea facilities. That technology has been around easily for a half a century or more, and there are three ways to get a big undersea facility. You can tunnel out from on land using tunnel boring machines. You just drop a shaft straight down, assemble your tunnel boring machine, and commence tunneling straight out to sea. But in the bedrock, you're down in the rock, so the water doesn't enter. Because of the great pressure of the seafloor, it actually seals, it presses down on the rock and seals the rock very effectively. So you can tunnel, you know, however far you want, 50 miles, 150 miles, 350 miles. It's depending on what you want, where you want to go. And of course, if you had 10 tunnel boring machines and each machine can bore 8 miles per year, you can go 80 miles in a year. And in 10 years, you could go 800 miles in just one decade with just 10 machines. And that's well within the state of the art of the underground tunneling industry. In fact, that's been state of the art for decades. So given that we're talking about an R&D period here of half a century or maybe more, but you could have thousands of miles of tunnels by now, easily, just with 10 machines and 10 crews. Now, the amount of money in the black budget runs to trillions, multiple trillions of dollars. So money's not an object. Secrecy's not an object. The military agencies and the major engineering firms, civil engineering firms that contract with the major government agencies, have thousands of trained personnel. They routinely work on compartmentalized projects, whether for industry or for the military intelligence agencies or the various other agencies. So secrecy is no issue. And you see, what I'm saying here is that given the documentation I've found, what I've been told, and the type of technology and secrecy that exists, I'm giving you odds of somewhere north of 100% that this has been done. We just don't know to what extent. That's all. Now, I've been told there are tunnels on both coasts of North America where military submarines are brought in, and then there are bases underground where the submarines surface. And I just don't know how far inland the tunnels go. I was thinking hundreds of yards, maybe a mile or two, but whether they go inland 20 miles or 50 miles or 100 miles, I don't know. What I'm telling you is, if they want to, the technology and the money and the secrecy and the personnel and expertise exist to do that. All I'm telling you is, the stories are there. I don't have conclusive documentation of that, but in theory, is that possible? Yes.
It's too bad that this information doesn't necessarily make us feel better. You know, it just starts making your head start spinning into...
It's like something that Morpheus told Neo in the first Matrix movie. Something along the lines of, I never told you it would be easy, Neo. I only promised you the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, is it just... Is the world, do we really have that many enemies? And if the ones that we have on Earth that actually do exist, if that's not enough, now we're preparing to do battle with those outside our planetary boundary? Is that where we're headed here?
Those from outside the planetary boundary may be straw men that are also part of another very highly compartmentalized, high-tech, black-budget project. Now, one of the things that ayahuasca impressed on me, and I drank a fair amount of ayahuasca and also some other shamanic brews, is that, as I said, this reality that we're in is so fake. It's so fraudulent. When I saw that and I first grasped it, the initial time when ayahuasca hit me with that, my impression was, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Because it's all just a fraud. It's hard to describe how fraudulent this reality that we're living in. It's beyond fake. It's so unimaginable that if the veil actually drops and we see the situation as it is, I'm persuaded a lot of people will just fall down in a catatonic fit. They won't be able to process how lied to, how massively lied to they have been their entire life from cradle to grave, across the board in every particular. It's like the ultimate theme park ride where everything is fake and false and spun up out of thin air to confuse you, and with the real, very hard, demonic edge to it. It's malevolent to an extreme. What's behind this does not mean well. The enemies we have are not natural. Not natural. The natural world does not mean us harm. We are part of the natural world. The natural world is the proper environment in which we are nourished, in which we swim, in which we are developed, in which we develop and grow, because we are essentially natural. Our inherent nature is natural. But we are hard up against this vast, cunning, Machiavellian, very violent, malevolent, artificial something, which I've called the machine. And it does not mean us well. You know, there have been warnings recently in the press, openly in the mainstream news media even, about the dangers of artificial intelligence, about the dangers of rampant robotics, of developing this new generation of basically thinking self-aware machines. It's no good hypothesizing that something like this might one day happen. This reality is being brought into development right now. And even today, there's a headline about Elon Musk, who is a major industrialist and financier. I mean, this man knows something about the technological development trajectory on planet Earth, because he works with it every day at a high level. And he's putting together a team to analyze the dangers of artificial intelligence. So if someone like him is doing that, you know the problem is well advanced. And to reach actually into the mainstream news media, where that is becoming a topic of open conversation, makes me wonder if maybe it's not already too late or almost too late. Things are well advanced. In my second book, I wrote, mentioned briefly, close to the beginning, an anecdote that was related to me by Bill Hamilton. I don't know if you know Bill, do you?
No, I don't think I do.
Well, anyway, Bill Hamilton, he's elderly now, but during his working career was a very high-level computer programmer. He worked for a number of large organizations and agencies, but at a high level, not an entry level. He was a master programmer. One of his jobs was in Arizona, and he had an ex-military colleague who had been involved in a program at White Sands Missile Range in South Central New Mexico, where he would to access his workstation. He would go to an underground tube train platform on White Sands and take a very high-speed tube shuttle train to his underground workstation, to an underground facility, which he could not say exactly where it was, because once you're underground and you're zooming along at high speed, you know if you're going east, west, north, south, you know you're going real fast. Are you going 100 miles per hour, 300 miles per hour? Are you going to Texas, northern Mexico, Colorado, Nevada? You know, he couldn't say. But when he got to his workstation, after riding on the high-speed underground train, His work revolved around a self-aware, a very powerful self-aware computer who was named Irene. And I believe the story is true. We're all being told, we're all but being told in the popular press now that in the mainstream news media that artificial intelligence is here. That's the plain English translation of what Elon Musk is saying. If he's concerned about it, it means it's real. This is not a man that gets frightened at Book of Bears under his bed at night. This is a man who knows what's really going on in the world. So if this is coming out now in the mainstream news media, I'm guessing what happens in the compartmentalized super secret world of the military industrial espionage complex must have a lead time of 10 years, 20 years easy over what we see in our everyday world. So I'm presuming that the nuts and bolts of this anecdote are probably true, and that the American military agencies and espionage agencies have been working with artificial intelligence for a good many years now. And that raises the issue then of the largest connected computing network on the planet, doesn't it? Which is the internet. Is the internet awake and aware? And I'm guessing it is. Whether it awakened on its own past a certain threshold of connectivity and computing power, or whether it was helped or nudged or stimulated to awaken, I don't know. I'm guessing it is awake. I'm guessing this is one of the reasons that guys like Elon Musk are starting to be concerned. I would guess it's been awake for quite some time. It is even possible that the initial DARPA network, Defense Advanced Research Project Agency network, from which the internet developed more than 20 years ago, it may have been designed to be awake and aware. And it may just be vastly more awake and aware now than it was before. That's my strong impression. Now, that would then imply that things like Skype and all the Google suite of products, Apple, Microsoft, Yahoo, all of them are plugged into this. Oh, we're in a brave new world, my man, and I think it's only going to get braver and newer. This thing, then, this artificial intelligence that ayahuasca has called my attention to over and over again, and when you see it, oh, it's hard. It's like looking straight into the unblinking eye of a rattlesnake. It's that kind of hard. You're thinking, oh, God, please, Jesus, help us. Help me do something. Because it's unsettling, and it's big, and it's like a rattlesnake that's just lurking. You never know what it's thinking. And truthfully, the rattlesnake is not going to divulge its plans to you right up until the time it sinks its fangs into your leg. You know, you could even say the rattlesnake has a type of love for the little baby rabbit that it's getting ready to devour. It loves it so much that it wants the rabbit to be one with its inner being.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it.
Well, that's the rattlesnake's perspective.
Absolutely.
And you know, all it wants is oneness. The fuzzy feelings, the rattlesnake wants that. It wants to partake of that. It wants to wrap itself around that and just hug it to death, so to speak, literally.
Because I just love you.
Exactly. Love you to death. And so this machine, we're dealing with a similar mentality. It's a mentality. It's not a spirituality. And it's not, I wouldn't say, a reptilian mentality. It's a machine mentality. The machine wants to be one with us. It wants what we have. It wants to devour us because we have what it doesn't, a connection to the divine creative layer of reality through our hyperdimensional DNA, which the DNA, which the machine does not have. And so what does a machine then do in order to devour the human race. Once it arrives, through whatever means, in the vicinity of the earth and humanity, whether that means is purely mental or physical or a combination of that, doesn't matter, it's here. It wants to know, how does it get us? How does it incorporate us? That's what the rattlesnake wants. It just wants to be one with the bunny rabbit. It wants to incorporate the bunny rabbit into its rattlesnake essence. It wants it really bad. And this appears to be what the machine wants. But how does it do that? Well, it turns out it has to involve a lot of us into its plans and use us as its instruments on Earth. And that indeed is what is happening. So you have, in my, from my point of thinking, my point of view, either the machine is consciously behind the development of the internet and these robotics and NSA surveillance and spying. Either it is in the CIA's surveillance and Google and all of the rest of this, and has directly, perhaps mentally or spiritually, spurred people like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates and all the others who set up this stuff to build it a network that will facilitate its conquest, its taking down, its devouring of this planet. Or these agencies such as the NSA, the CIA, and so forth, through their projects, their remote viewing projects and other projects, including quantum computing, things like that, stumbled across the machine and said to themselves, well, don't you know there's someone out there even more evil than us? We love it. You know, we're spiritual brothers. And consciously, at a high level, decided to, shall we say, throw in with the machine, make common cause with the machine, because they recognize in the machine an evil of such depth that even they are trembling and gleeful all at its deep evil. Because we are dealing here with tremendous evil. We're dealing with something that intends to destroy humanity and is destroying humanity. We're dealing with something that intends to take down the biosphere on this planet. And by God, it is doing that. It is taking the biosphere right down and hard. It's something that may even end up physically blowing up the planet through these massively powerful military technologies that have been developed over the past 70 or 80 years. We're dealing with hard, wicked evil, and it does not mean us well, and we need to wrap our minds around that and start dealing with that. The Bone Lady clued me into deep aspects of this already at the age of 3. And this gets to your question of my motivation and whether I have hope for this project called Humanity on Earth and the Earth itself, or whether it's too late to do anything, and related questions. And my answer was yes, no, and maybe. And that's still my answer. It all depends. It's contextual. The context has to do with consciousness. Do we choose expanded consciousness, higher awareness, to grow and develop in the direction of what you might call cosmic consciousness, God consciousness, union with the highest, higher and highest creative and good and compassionate, loving levels of the cosmos? Or do we choose to go this very evil, cunning, Machiavellian, negative, destructive direction that the machine is leading us? You see, that's our choice. It all comes down to consciousness. What kind of consciousness do you want? And if we prefer to go on a positive, loving, creative, productive, increasingly wise level of awareness, then yes, we have hope individually as a species and as a planet. If we do not, then I think we're done for.
All right, now let me ask you this. Activism. It's one thing to know the path. It's another thing to walk it. So, how do we walk it? How do we walk it? I mean, are we just going to be these? Go ahead, you start to answer. I don't want to embellish.
Well, it's an excellent question. It is precisely to the point, and I only regret that more people aren't asking it. But you know what? You are, and that's the beginning. So let's explore the answer. Let me start by mentioning another radio host, Alex Jones. On Alex Jones' program, and Alex has never had me on. I don't believe he ever will. For me, that says something about Alex Jones' program right there. He doesn't want to have the conversations that I've had with so many other hosts. I don't know who or what may or may not be behind Alex Jones, but for whatever reason, I've never done his program and probably never will, even though I live 10 years in Texas, just an hour and a half drive away from his studios, and could easily have come down and talked to him for hours at a time. Never happened and never will. But there are frequent advertisements on his website and his show for guns, for assault rifles. And I'm here to tell you that I don't believe that we are going to shoot our way out of this situation with automatic gunfire. Our problem is at a far deeper level. Essentially, our problem is one of consciousness, lack of higher consciousness. And I believe the only way we will resolve this situation is through the acquiring of higher consciousness and the intelligent application of higher consciousness in the world. And to my mind, going out with an automatic rifle and spraying the hated other with automatic rifle fire saying, you know, die, you SOB. To my mind, that's a perpetuation of the underlying problem, which is that we should annihilate it ourselves so that this machine intelligence, whatever it is, whoever it is, wherever it comes from, whenever and however it was built and why ever, whatever, it's here, and it is dragging us down to ruin. And the more people it can get to take up automatic rifles and go out and spray each other with bursts of gunfire, hey, the less it has to do. We're wiping each other out. I think a more intelligent approach is, number one, a lot more conversations like this on a lot more radio shows with hundreds of thousands and millions of listeners, number one. And not just by me, and not just by you, because if it's just me and just you, then we're outnumbered about 7 billion to 2. So it has to be a lot more people, meaning, and I don't like those odds, by the way.
No.
But if what I'm saying is, and this is a point the Bone Lady made to me implicitly, it's not just about Richard Souter, and it's not just about John B. Wells. Ultimately, it's about the whole planet. It's a group decision. Everyone has skin in this game. So this implies directly that there are people who are listening to this conversation that must take the ball and run with it. In other words, go after higher consciousness. I have a certain level of consciousness. I would be delighted if 10 billion people would vastly exceed my level of consciousness. It would make things, don't you know, so much easier for me. So I would be delighted to have many thousands, millions of people, tens and hundreds of millions of people vastly, vastly exceed my level of consciousness and act productively and creatively on their higher consciousness in the world. And how do you do that? Well, as many different ways as there are people. You know, my way of doing things won't be exactly your way of doing things, and thank goodness for that. Because if everyone's way of doing things was my way, then there would be an entire world of just me, and I don't want that. That seems dreadfully boring. Variety is the spice of life. So every person who awakens, every person who acquires another increment, another quantum of higher consciousness, we can think of it as a Jacob's ladder, if you want, moving higher up a ladder of consciousness into angelic and divine realms of consciousness. But living out that consciousness on earth. How do you do that? One person's going to plant a lot of trees. One person is going to heal a lot of people. One person is going to, et cetera. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There are many ways to take creative, loving, productive, positive, healthful, healing action on this planet. Many ways. Some people have medical training. Some people have technical training in a variety of engineering disciplines. Some people are gifted, they're mechanically inclined. Working on and building and creating, maintaining machinery comes naturally and easy to them. Some people are gifted with music. On and on. Some people write well. I had terrible writer's block when I was younger, in my teens and 20s, and now I've written a few little books, and I have a widely read blog. And so you never know what gifts you have until you start to develop your life. And that's another thing that this terrible artificial control mechanism that's clamped down on this planet has done. It has squelched and quashed the life energy of so many humans and distorted people's lives to where very few people are naturally living out the aptitudes and gifts that they were gifted with at birth, that's in them to express. It's been squished out of them by years of legally mandated institutional education, and then people go in the military and they're taught how to kill. And some of them even come home from war and kill their wives. They can't turn it off. They come home and they whack their woman. And we see this all the time. People that live near military bases like Fort Bragg, for example, in North Carolina, there's been a whole rash of these guys that come back from war, and they can't turn it off. They kill their wife.
Yeah.
And so we're deep into this. Well, they killed other people's wives, and then they come home and they kill their own wife. You see how ugly our system is. It's just vicious. And how do you stop that? Well, to begin with, I would suggest maybe we need to have more laying down of automatic rifles than picking up of automatic rifles, just for starter.
Yeah.
And then more conversation. You know, I've been impressed with what Vladimir Putin has said in recent weeks and months. More than once he's remarked that, you know, we prefer, meaning the Russian government and him, to resolve international tension and problems by diplomatic and political means rather than military means. To me, that's a way of expressing at a very high level on the part of a national leader, the leader of a major country on this planet. That's his way of saying, much the same way as what I've just said. In his case, Vladimir Putin, what is his gift? Politics at a high level. There are people with a gift for politics at a high level. And by whatever means, however, he's arrived to be the leader of Russia and for the last 15 years or so. And instead of saying, well, you know, we've got a powerful military, and if we see a problem, we'll just take care of it. That's the attitude of the American leadership. You know, there's a problem on the other side of the world, we'll send in the Marines. We'll just come in with guns blazing, and they do. With Tomahawk cruise missiles and B-52 carpet bombing, they fly the B-1s halfway around the world from Whitman Air Force Base in Missouri to bomb from 40,000 feet. They do all of that and more in countries that have never done a thing to the United States. You could say that's the polar opposite of the American, of the Russian policy, where Vladimir Putin is saying we prefer to resolve international issues by political and diplomatic means as opposed to military means, which for us are the last option. Whereas for the American government, frequently military means are the first option. And then after 10, 15, 20 years of chaos, they try to impose a diplomatic solution by NATO or something. And so I'm saying, you know, I've been in jail. I spent a lot of time in jail in the United States in different prisons and jails and correctional facilities in several different states over a period of years. And I think the most pressing issue facing the United States is the government and the population across the board are desperately in need of raising their level of consciousness. Because in the United States now, there is a pervasive, very low, debased level of consciousness, which finds its most evil expression in sending the young men and women of the United States halfway around the world to slaughter in large numbers people who have never done one thing to us. And don't you know, that is deeply evil.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, Richard, day before yesterday, Mr. Ghost and I, everybody on the caravan knows Mr. Ghost. He's somebody very near and dear to me. You spoke with him a little while ago. We didn't really understand what was eating at us, but it is exactly, or was exactly, it still is trying to gnaw a little bit, but it's exactly what you're talking about. I saw this ridiculous succession of Supreme Court decisions, several of them in patent violation of constitutional law. And it occurred to me, combining this with what DJ said, we know her last name, but we don't release it over the program, simply to slightly enhance the security, not only of her, but also people near and dear to her. With this AI exercise in the form of Jade Helm being run up here, I thought, these are absolutely ludicrous initiatives that these people are putting forward, these people in government. Are they trying to stress everybody out with this stuff so much that then the AI apparatus can measure us more accurately, our response to it? Because the response to the stress seems to be part and parcel to the whole Jade Helm exercise, the AI takeover of this this predictive, algorithmic, asymmetrical warfare scenario that these maniacs are putting together. And look... Look, I'm ticked off about this, and I'll tell you why. I do a program, I narrate a program called Unsealed Alien Files. And as you go through these things, I know of many episodes, I'm using the word many, that we were not permitted to run. Because it disturbs people. And when you find out that the three-letter agencies are all over the production centers of the world, specifically L.A. and New York, well, then you understand, well, maybe it got a little bit too close to home or something. But, I mean, shouldn't we be resentful that our school systems are dumbing everyone down to the point of just, not just ignorance, but almost primitivia? And that anything by way of discovery out in space, whether those craft belong to us or whether they belong to someone else, oh, we can't know anything about that. Oh, we can't know about any really cool technological advances that might benefit humanity. Oh, no, that's all secret. That's for us. And these idiots just continue to build these weapons. And it's as you say, you know, where do these guys come from? When you were in jail, by the way, I haven't asked you why you were in there. It's not really any of my business, but you keep mentioning it. But anyway, you were talking about the stupidity of, like, the guards, the judges, the cops that arrest you, and everything else. There is sort of a moronic common mentality once you get on to that level of, you know, inhumanity, really.
It pervades the entire system, the entire culture. I was in jail because I was a peaceful anti-nuclear protester, and I have peacefully demonstrated at nuclear missile silos in Arkansas, Missouri, and North Dakota, and also at naval bases on the East Coast in Georgia and in Florida, talking about the United States, of course, over a period of years, for which I was arrested and incarcerated repeatedly in several different states. And after I was released most recently in 2010, decided to, after visiting friends and family, to come to South America. I don't intend to spend even one more day in the empire's people cages. I spent too many days, weeks, months, and more in the empire's people cages. And don't you know, there are more people cages than ever, and more people in those people cages for more reasons, many of them ludicrous, Now, of course, if you go out and start killing people, I think you need to be separated physically from society because you have self-selected at that point, and I don't have any issue with physically segregating violently criminal personalities from the rest of society. But in my case, my great crime was publicly objecting at the scene of the crime to preparations for nuclear warfare. And that is, you cannot go there. You cannot do that. You will be locked up. And I was again and again and again and again and again. Now, that is why I was in jail, and the crime was always, alleged crime, was misdemeanor trespass on United States military reservations. Meaning I went over the fence onto a nuclear missile silo or something like that. And that would get you taken away in handcuffs and chains.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's true.
But the issue is, and I was, I've been fined, jailed, imprisoned, lectured, ridiculed, mocked, scorned, threatened with death more times than I remember, on and on, fired from work, I've lost my residence, I mean, on and on, all kinds of things. It's something I did because I had in me. Listen, if you had a mind-to-mind chat with the Bone Lady, or with some of these other entities I've encountered, and you could still just concern yourself purely with watching NHL hockey or the NBA, only the NBA, or eating pizza, drinking beer, and nothing more. And by the way, I just described millions and millions of people whose lives are just that shallow. They don't rise any higher than that. That's it. That's what you see when you deal with those people. And that's quite a large slice of American society, of North American society. But when you go beyond that level and say, by the way, I have noticed that you are making multi-trillion dollar preparations to exterminate all life on this world, and I object to that. When you reach that point, then they come for you with chains and handcuffs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if everyone objects, then they don't come for you with chains and handcuffs, because at that point they're outnumbered 1,000 to 1. But if just one or two people object here and there, they can pick you off one by one.
Sure.
However, if no one ever anywhere objects at all, well, then you see your totalitarian enslavement is complete. So as long as you have Richard Sounders out there, well, you see the control program has an issue, doesn't it? Because as long as there's even one or two Richard Sounders, it means things are not totally under control from their standpoint, and that bothers them. I like to use the block of Jell-O analogy. They see there's Richard Sounder over there. He's out of control, so we're going to put him under control. We're going to grab him with the long, firm arm of the law in a vice grip and close him down. So they clamp down on me. But like Jell-O, I instantly squish through their fingers. Now, I rather like the Jell-O analogy because all of us have played with Jell-O as kids, squished it through our teeth, tried to grab it with our little grubby toddler hand, and you can't do it. It cannot be controlled. So I begun telling people, you know, listen, grasshopper, do thou be like the block of Jell-O. Embrace your inner squishiness. That's your salvation, man. So if we had, instead of one, say, a Richard Sounder block of Jell-O, if there were 100 million blocks of Jell-O, well, the control problem becomes impossible.
Embrace your inner squishiness.
Your
I like it,
block,
man.
Your inner block of Jell-O.
Soupy Sales used to say, remember, boys and girls, it wiggles.
Yeah, something like that.
Maybe it wriggles out of its cuffs. I like it.
Something like that. In other words, I'm expressing my Jell-O-ness, and I think I just violated a trademark there, and good, by the way. I'm expressing my jealousy in my own way. You're doing it your own way.
Yes.
Your gig is a radio thing, and if there was no one doing radio, then we wouldn't be doing this. So your jello thing is radio. Your jello block is radio. My jello block is, well, it's all kinds of things. It's Richard Souders off in different directions. But everyone, my point is we're all different. We're all nature has given us all something. You could say, well, look at Helen Keller. She couldn't hear, she couldn't see, et cetera, et cetera. What's she going to do? It turns out quite a lot.
Yes.
And so whatever your circumstances are, you might say, well, I can't do much. Well, do what you can. You might say, well, my block of jello is not very big. Well, work with the block you have. You can only do, you know, live your life where you are. You cannot live your life where you are not.
Well, yeah.
So whatever.
You know, and you're Helen Keller. And go ahead. You finish your thought. Go on.
Well, the thing is that these are just common sense observations, but we are not meant to have common sense observations. We are meant to think your perspectives on the law don't matter. Only the Supreme Court's view matters.
Isn't that just ridiculous? This has just slipped so far down the toilet.
Exactly. And when you read the Constitution, you don't understand it because you're not a federal judge. Only a federal judge can read the Constitution and interpret it. And I'm here to tell you, the federal judges I've come before are incompetent, corrupt idiots. They are some of the worst mental midgets on the planet, man. Now, and they're dangerous. They're dangerously stupid. And yet we are taught in school to defer to these morons. We're instructed that when some guy with a gun and a pump shotgun and mace and a taser and a pistol and a badge comes up to you, he's 18 years old, just out of school, doesn't have half the education you have, doesn't have half the life experience you have. When that guy body slams you on the ground, busts your teeth out, and tases you to within an inch of your life, that you must obey that maniac because he is Mr. Policeman.
Hmm. Well, I can't argue with very much of what you're saying. I can't really add very much to it. It's just we seem to be, and you know, more than just the clearly nefarious purposes behind what this government thing. What is the machine? Is it just the authoritarian structure? Or?
I think it's an expression that's part of it as we encounter it in our everyday lives. This police state, the prisons, the warfare, the taxation. Why should you be taxed?
Well, we pay tax every day. I mean,
but even without filling out a form. Why? Why? If the government is printing the money, the government and the Federal Reserve Bank are printing the money. They just print it out of thin air, and they give it to you. And then they say, through a very complex mechanism called the global economy, you get this stuff in your hands called money. And because you acquire some of this money, they say, aha, you have X amount of money, you therefore must give X percentage of that money to us.
That's right.
But they themselves created the money.
Yeah,
so why do you need to give to them the very thing that they create? Answer me. Well,
I would say it's a control issue so they can keep
it's
up with what you
issue.
Have.
If they're making it in the first place and they need 10 more money, whatever money is, they say, we need 10 more money. And they're the ones making it. Logically, why don't they just make 10 more money? Since they're the ones making it anyway, why do they need to come to you and say, we need 10 more money? Hey, you give us 10 more money. Why? Since they're the ones who made it originally, why don't they just make it and give it to themselves?
Well, that's a very good question, but then again, that would take the control aspect out of things, wouldn't it?
It would. It would, and I'm not Mr. Policeman, am I? And I'm not Mr. Federal Judge, am I?
No.
And I'm not Mr. President of the United States, am I? So those aren't the questions that Mr. Policeman asks. Those are the questions that the person at whom Mr. Policeman points his gun asks.
Yeah.
See, I think if you're making the money, if you have the printing press to make the money, and you say, well, I need more money, why ask me for money? Why don't you just make it yourself? Since that's what they do, they manufacture money. They manufacture money. They physically manufacture it, and they electronically manufacture it. Here's how the Federal Reserve makes money when they do what's called quantitative easing. They have their personnel sit down at computers down at Federal Reserve headquarters, and they type up $1 trillion quantitative easing to go to the big banks in the United States. Then they send $100 billion to J.P. Morgan Chase. They send $100 billion to the Bank of America, et cetera, et cetera. It's all electronic transfers. Now, you're sitting there, and you're looking, and you're expecting entire freight car loads of $100 bills to be unloaded at a loading dock at J.P. Morgan Chase Bank or you know, at Bank of America. It doesn't work that way. They just send them a wire transfer saying, guess what? We just sent you $100 billion more dollars. That's the way it works. And I get it back around to my original question. If that's the way it works for them, why do they need to come to you every year and say, you must give us 14% of all you have or 28% of all you have, and if you don't, you go to jail? Isn't the proper response, well, if you need more money, why don't you just sit down at your computer keyboard and type in, hey, guess what? I just gave myself $1 trillion more dollars. Is life great or what? Because that's how they make money.
Hmm. All right, I want to ask your opinion on something. This may not be your thing, Richard, but
yes.
What do you make of these vaccinations and these forced vaccinations? I consider Jim Carrey to be a pretty funny guy in the movies. I think he's an idiot where gun control is concerned, but I get his point. It would be good if they were strictly for sporting purposes and absolutely nothing else. There was no self-defense component even necessary, because the self-defense necessity component did not exist in human beings, but alas, that's not the case. So I still roll with better to have it and not need it than to need it and not have it, because you'll be the victim if you don't, okay, in certain circumstances. But even he's railing against this. California is like mandatory vaccinations, and it's clear that the government has concealed data regarding the damage that it causes to children.
Well, that's part of the control mechanism.
Oh, I'm sure.
This all began in the post-World War II period in a major way. I remember as a kid back in the 50s, where we would go to school gymnasiums and get polio vaccines and other vaccines. That's when they really started making that big push, I think, was in the 1950s.
Yeah, did you get the sugar cube?
Yeah, all that stuff. And I'm sure it did damage to me that I'm still suffering from today. But the thing is that it's never stopped. Once they started, they just kept going. And they're seemingly there more than ever. And now the legal... the legal environment is changing to where it's becoming mandatory by the state. You must take your kids in and have them shot up with God knows what. For me, of course, the question is, what else is in them besides the pathogens that they're theoretically inoculating you against? Nanotechnology has advanced greatly in recent years and decades. And I strongly suspect that there will be just a whole witch's brew of vile components and ingredients in those injections. How would we know if there was some kind of Terminator mechanism in these injections, such that You could be extinguished with a flip of a switch somewhere down the line because you have a certain miniaturized electronic circuit in you that has coupled with your DNA or something like that, such that if it becomes imperative from the point of view of the controllers to take you out some future point, they just flip a switch and you, guess what? You have sudden cardiac arrest.
Yeah.
See, I don't rule that out at all.
No.
I don't rule that out at all because, I repeat, what we're dealing with here is pure evil. And even on the basis of, even if the vaccinations are harmless, there's a profit motive here by making it mandatory, guarantees multi-billion dollar profit windfalls for the big pharmaceutical companies, even if these vaccinations are as good as the government is maintaining, and I don't believe them for 1 minute. You know, they haven't reached that point yet in the countries here in South America, and maybe if the American system collapses in the coming months and year or two, they won't. I've reached a point where at this point, I feel like it would be a big blessing if the United States government would fail. It would be a blessing for those people who live in North America. It would certainly be a blessing for those people who are being even now murdered by the sons and daughters of the United States who have come to their country to kill them in American military uniforms. And I just described many countries and horrific crimes that are being carried out as a matter of state policy right now by the United States government. So in many ways, I believe it would be a blessing for humanity were the system in the United States to fail due to its own massive intrinsic evil. Because whatever good intentions may have been there in the beginning, I hope there were. Increasingly, I'm asking, were there? Because if you read the history of the United States, it starts virtually from the beginning with the settlers starting to kill the Indians. And then millions of black slaves were brought in. And then you had the so-called Indian Wars in the 19th century, which were just slaughters and massacres. So for those who think that there was some pure, noble past in the United States, was there? Ever?
Yeah. Well, all right. Let me ask you this then. Looking into your crystal ball, which I know you don't, you have crystals, but I'm not sure you have a crystal ball. By the way, I have some too. Marjorie Wildcraft sent me some.
I don't have any crystals at the time. At this time, they're
oh,
all
don't?
Up north. No, the cops took my feather headdress from me. I'll never see that again.
What? What's wrong with them? Why?
Well, they steal from all kinds of people all the time, man.
That's
and
right.
If you any encounter with a policeman in the United States, they have asset forfeiture laws. There are just many, many instances where people have been accosted by a policeman, have even had thousands of dollars stolen from them, including their vehicle, with not even an allegation of criminal activity, and have never regained their property. This happens daily in the United States. I never got my vehicle back. I never got my headdress back. My necklaces I did get back because I wore them to jail, and so they were there in the jail property. But I don't have them with me. They're in the United States. My point is, a lot of cops in the United States, and listen to me carefully, a lot of them are thieves, nothing better.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of people know that one.
Thieves.
Even so retired ones. We know of somebody recently who had actually a couple of firearms. That his father passed away, and this retired policeman said, oh, this one's borderline illegal. Let me just take care of these. And this SOB stole them from the guy's grandmother because she didn't know any better. She trusted this stupid cop to, you know, be honest, and of course he's not. And that's not to say that there aren't honest cops out there. Believe me, there are. But it really only takes one really rotten apple to wreck the barrel, and that's just the plain truth of it, you know. So just remember that. I'm not anti good cop, but I'm totally anti bad cop completely.
In a flawed society, there is a necessity for peacekeepers or intermediaries, whatever you want to call them. So many policemen today in the United States have become killers, thieves, liars, and worse. And we see evidence of that every day. YouTube is full of videos. You could spend, I don't know, weeks, maybe months, researching the murders by police in the United States in recent years. No one knows how many every year. Conservatively, hundreds, several hundred every year are murdered. Not justifiably killed in line of duty, are murdered by police in the United States every year. No one knows the numbers, and the police departments are not reporting the numbers. So, and that's just one example. I'm sure they're good policemen. It's just that their numbers are dwindling.
Yeah.
Their numbers are dwindling.
No, and go on back.
My point is,
go ahead.
My point is, why should you obey a thief, a murderer, a liar? And yet we are taught that just because someone comes up to you with a gun and a badge, you must obey them. And they are taught that if you do not, they may do anything to you, up to and including kill you on the spot.
Yeah. Well, going back to that crystal ball thing, let me ask you this. How much worse do you think it will get? And how soon do you think it will get that way?
Well, let me tell you. What the Bone Lady showed me 57 years ago was sobering, with a heavy emphasis on the sobering part. As of today, right now, I don't see massive numbers of people awakening. I see a certain number, a small percentage, awakening or beginning to awake, to enter the first stages of raising their consciousness. Would that that process were about a century, 100 years farther along than it is. Given that, it is only now beginning to begin. I'm afraid that some very bad things are about to happen. How bad? Well, I read a paper by the United States military. Perhaps you know the one I'm referring to. I can't conjure up the title of it right now. But speaking of great mass mortality in the coming decades because of degraded conditions on the earth. And this, you do not need to be a military analyst to wrap your mind around. From Fukushima alone, the effects from Fukushima alone, if they continue, guarantee the deaths of millions of people. We don't know how many millions, but we do know it will be millions, if only because of the loss of food production from the North Pacific. All of that fish, all of the crabs, the shrimp, the oysters, the clams, sardines, anchovies, is all going bye-bye as we're talking. It's all dying. The Pacific Ocean is dying. It is about 30% of the Earth's surface. It's dying. It's going down. We don't know how to stop it. We're not stopping it. That alone, when 30% of the Earth dies, you do the math and you tell me, what does that mean?
I would tell people, read their Bible. It tells you all about it.
So how bad could it get? I'm telling you, if you're living in Yemen or Iraq or Libya or Gaza, Afghanistan, it's already very bad if you're still alive.
Yeah.
But much of that courtesy of the United States military, by the way. Now, so that's just the beginning. In other words, what a lot of people in the United States have failed to understand is this is the thought process. This is the implicit thought process, and it's supremely arrogant and evil. Notwithstanding that a lot of so-called Christian people go through this thought process, imagining themselves to be holy and Christian. But let me finish. They have not just for years or for decades, but for the better part of a century, have sent their young men and now also their young women to other countries to kill people, not by the hundreds or the thousands, or even tens or hundreds of thousands, but by the millions. All the while, imagining themselves to be Christians, imagining their children to be good boys and girls, and imagining the United States to be a godlike, God-fearing nation. How can you wipe out millions of people who've done nothing to you and imagine yourself to be good or Christian? You explain that to me.
Can't do it.
No, which means there's a huge spiritual debt of evil hanging over the head of the United States. And I've been in so many Christian churches. I've seen young men and women come back in their uniforms from Iraq and so forth and Vietnam and what have you. And the pastor calls them out for their service. Service to what?
Yeah.
I would think that Jesus' service is loving, is life enhancing. When you go and perform service with automatic weapons, blowing people away, and then you come before Jesus and Jesus says, well, let's take a look at your life. Oh, I see you went to Vietnam. What did you do in Vietnam? Well, I was, sir, I was in the United States Army, and I was decorated for my service. Oh, I see, and what did you get for that decoration? Sir, I killed people, sir. Well, which people did you kill? 500 people, sir. Very dead. 500 very dead. I see, and do you know those people you killed, whose people they were? No, sir. The people you killed happened to be my people. Oh, begging your pardon, sir. Yes, and 500 times you did this. You killed my people. And one of my commands is, thou shalt not kill. And yet you violated my command 500 times. Do you see the problem, son? Oh, yes, sir. I see there could be a problem. I killed 500 of your people. And this is no exaggeration. It's so much worse than that. So when this God to which, why don't we call out John Hagee too? I've had it with this harumphing blowtoad down there in San Antonio because he's so supportive of all these wars, pretending to be Christian the whole while. And he's not alone. You got a bunch of others. Pat Robertson. I mean, there's just a whole long list of them. This guy Joel Osteen down in Houston. I mean, all these fake, lying, so-called Christians don't have anything to do with Jesus. Don't know Jesus. Wouldn't know him if they passed him in the street. And they countenance the mass destruction of human life. The last time I checked, human species was created by God. And yet these people who claim to be in God's service devote their career either actively or to the extent of praising those who go away to industrially slaughter their fellow human beings. I would submit that's bad business. That's real bad karma. And when I say things are going to get really bad, if the law of karma is true, if it's true on a spiritual level that there's a reaction for every action and that it's proportionate, that's true in the physical realm. If that's also true in the spiritual realm, oh my, I wouldn't want to be the guy that flew a B-52 carpet bombing North Vietnam. I wouldn't want to be the pilot of the Enola Gay that dropped an atom bomb on Hiroshima. I wouldn't want to be the guy. I've been in jail with guys who are ex-American military, and they are messed up. Messed up, man, because being in the American military, because of all the evil that they both saw and did. And you can't go and do all that evil and come back and everything is just okay. Doesn't work like that.
You know, this has been a fascinating conversation, Richard. I'm not kidding you. It's it's refreshing. It's not over till it's over. You know, I got an email today from somebody who said, look, you know, it's not over till it's over. And you look around the world at these various websites that most Americans have no idea about. This program, and when I was on Coast to Coast, I tried to raise their awareness of one in particular called Full Spectrum Dominance with dashes between the words. because you will see articles there that you don't see anywhere else. But more and more people are waking up, and I do believe that they're waking up faster and faster every day. And that is why these authoritarians have decided to advance their agenda faster and faster every day. I mean, it's just one atrocious agenda point being pushed in people's faces every day. Now, I mean, did no one see this coming, that Twitter and Facebook were going to be used as political engines? Now you would think that every black church in the southern states of America are on fire, and it's white racists doing it. I mean, can do to keep us divided, baby, that's what they're going to do. Go ahead.
You raise a good point, and that is a lot of people still don't understand to what great extent the American alphabet agencies, not only them, but especially them, more than any other country in the world. Let me repeat that. Especially them. I'm talking about the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the United States State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, TSA, all of these alphabet soup agencies. They're wicked. Their objective is not to protect Americans or to help America or to help the world. There's a very cruel, wicked, vile agenda of social control up to and including murder. I am telling you, the CIA and the FBI kill people. They set people up. They entrap people. They lie. They steal. They cheat. They backstab. I'll give you an example. Once I washed windows for many years, after I finished I have three graduate degrees, by the way, two masters and a PhD. And when I finished my PhD, I had some illusions at the beginning as to going to work in the system to do something good. By the time I got my PhD, it was clear to me that, no, it's not a good system, and I am not going to be working in it. Mm-hmm. So I went away, and I washed windows as an independent contractor for many years. One of my customers, not only one, but one in particular, was an ex-Air Force intelligence officer. And I talked with him many hours over the years as I was cleaning windows at his house. At one point, I asked him, you know, you were in Air Force intelligence. Did you ever think about working for the CIA, or did you? And he said, well, let me tell you what happened. The CIA came calling to him, as they do to a lot of people, evidently, and asked him to go to work for the CIA, to leave Air Force intelligence, and he turned them down. Do you know the reason he gave me?
No.
He said, Richard, I told them no. Because by that time, I understood that the CIA even kills their own. Here's what happens. And not only the CIA, but these other intelligence agencies, they think up some Rube Goldberg evil plot. And believe me, they got lots of them going. And they carry out their plot, which involves killing people, maybe a lot of them, whatever. It could be assassinating a president, including an American president, or someone in a foreign country, or blowing something up, or sinking a ship. I mean, they do all of these things and more. And when the operation is over, of course, the men, it's usually men, but not always, there are women in these agencies too. When it's over, who knows what happened? The people who carried out the operation. Well, don't you know that could be a problem if they ever talk? So in order to keep them from talking, you send your hit men around, or hit women, and you kill them. They're getting out of their car one night when they come back from work. Someone steps out from behind a bush. Boom. They're dead. The hit man doesn't know why he's killing the person. The person who's dead, who did know operational details, is now dead. And cannot talk because dead men and dead women tell no tales. That, boys and girls, is how your American government really works.
I'm afraid you're right. You know, I was just thinking, Some people will say, well, you just got crossways with some people and you're just bitter toward them. I mean, so, you know, there is somebody that's going to complain. I don't care what you do. Somebody's going to have a problem with it. But I hereby declare I don't have a problem with it. And so I would ask you, as we get near the witching hour, maybe not the witching hour, but at least the quitting hour, if you would indulge me in a short ceremony, and it's all about you. Now, you may not be familiar with this, but we do it. Many, many people who have not had this little ceremony inflicted on them are worthy of it, and we will get to it. But when somebody does as you have done and walks the path, doesn't just know it, doesn't just talk about it, it's got his education, an abundance of education, and has made the decision that you have made to just, as Guardian James, First Guardian James, an Englishman living in Western Europe, says, don't occupy, unoccupy you in the manner of Patrick McGoohan, the late Patrick McGoohan, visionary, author of the Prisoner series, which described this whole ridiculous matrix of stupidity that we live in now. Coming back around, finally, to reveal that it is the individual that is ultimately responsible in some way, in some significant and measurable way, to all of the ills that afflict the human being. You, Richard, have gloriously illustrated and vindicated the right of the individual to be individual. And I hereby induct you into the Order of the Ark Knights. And this assembly rises to you, Sir Richard. Thank you.
Well, thank you for those kind and generous words. I have a more humble view of myself than that. I would hasten to impress upon you that my life is very much incomplete and a work in progress. I'm aware of all of the ragged and raw edges and jagged edges in my own being. But I like one part of what you said. If you're going to break out of jail, you have to break out of jail. The jail keeper is never going to come to your cell with the keys and say, you know what, I'm a nice guy. Here are the keys. Open your cell and leave at your leisure. That's not going to happen. If that were his nature, he would not be a jailer. So if you're in jail, if you're going to break out of jail, you yourself have to find the courage to do it, because if you won't spring yourself from jail, no one's going to do it for you.
Well, just like Papillon, you know, McQueen wanted to go for it, but the other guy didn't. The little guy, I can't call his name to save my life right now. Who's that little actor? Dustin Hoffman. Yeah, he was just too shy. He just stayed there, right there in that horrible prison. And McQueen split.
I saw that movie years ago, and you're right. There's another analogy. If you're standing on a train track, and there's a 150-car freight train barreling down upon you at 65 miles per hour, if you don't jump off the track to save your own life, and the train runs over you and flattens you and turns you into hamburger, then whose fault is that? What I'm telling you is, save yourself if you can. If you don't have a self-preservation instinct, well, then I guess maybe yourself will not be preserved. So if you desire to be preserved, look around your personal environment and find your self-preservation instinct and use it, because we are coming up on the time now where, in a certain sense, God does help those who help themselves. He's given you a brain. He's given you hands and feet. He's given you understanding. If you fail to use the things that God has given you, then you have not accepted his gifts. And to my mind, that is not a wise decision.
No, in fact, it's an insult to the Creator. And anyone who has a depth of study in these matters says the same thing. So let's roll with the consensus. God bless you, sir.
Thank you so much.
May you be preserved, blessed, and we'll do what we can to spread your message. And if something gets your attention, please sing out to us. Don't wait for us to sing out to you. We're going to do that again anyway. But If something occurs to you that that you feel is important and you want to share it on this program, then we welcome your return.
That's fine. And of course, people can go to my blog, which is eventhorizonchronicle.blogspot.com. That's eventhorizonchronicle.blogspot.com. And I want to say finally in closing that, yes, good things can happen. But if we, flesh and blood human beings, don't either make the good things happen or don't facilitate the good things to happen, then they can't happen. So without our direct participation in goodness, good won't happen. So we have to turn our backs on all of that foul, dark wickedness that is being clamped down. Just turn our backs on it and turn towards goodness, towards creativity, towards compassion, towards love, towards higher consciousness. If we do that, then there's a way out. But if we refuse to do that, then I reiterate, we're done for, in my view.
Well said, sir. Take care. And thank you. I think what Richard is saying is that suit up, get your spikes on, get out on the field and tell the Almighty, here I am. I'm willing to do the work. I'm willing to do it. Indicate to me what you would have me do. Awaken me, awaken my senses. All of this stuff around me belongs to He, we say, who created it. Not to us, to the Creator. We're not here to just freelance and do whatever we want. We're here to help each other. There is evil in the world. Remember going through all that? What's really evil? Oh, really? Well, look around. And anything that makes you want to, any inhumane thing that you see going on, anything that destroys, perverts, distorts, or twists a creation into some form that causes you to recoil, that's evil. It's like pornography. What was it that Supreme Court Justice said? I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. I think he could have done a little bit better than that. Pornography is a twisting, a distorting, and a perverting of what was once a beautiful creation. That's what it is. It's exploitation on top of it all. So, consider deeply of Richard's speeches. Get your spikes on, suit up, get out on the field. Sooner or later, that ball is going to come your way. And when it does, grab onto it and head toward the end of the field that you're supposed to be running to. Don't look at the scoreboard. Just look down the field. Exercise caution in your daily affairs. Eyes up always. And make ready for what's to come. Be seeing you.